It is so great to be joined by, I'm going to still call you the Yale head coach, even though you're head coach emeritus in my book and always will be, Keith Alleyne, to another edition of Hockey Decision Makers from the ECAC. You know what's pretty interesting, coach? You're the first person to come back twice on the show, so we're really grateful to have you.
Wow, it's impressive that I got two cracks at this. So hopefully I do better than I did my first time, Pia. Great to see you.
No, you did fantastically well. It's so good to see you. You know, one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on is because it's an Olympic year. And I can't think of too many people in the United States that have the international hockey credibility that you have, whether it was being a head coach of three world junior teams, whether it was being an assistant coach with three Olympic teams, whether it was being an assistant coach in 96 at the World Cup. You got a spectacular array of international experience. How did that come upon you?
You're right. First of all, I've been truly blessed by my experiences with USA Hockey and the opportunities that it's given me in my career. How did it happen first? To be perfectly honest with you, I'm an assistant coach at Yale in 1983, and I'm at the coaches convention in Florida, and a gentleman named Keith Blaze was heading up USA Hockey's coaching programs for the first time, and they were looking for coaches to come do camps in the summer. And so I signed up. I literally spent every summer out in Colorado Springs, and I'd be a goalie coach at one camp. I'd be an assistant coach at one camp. I'd be a head coach at one camp. And I had the opportunity to work with really the best players in America and all the best coaches in America. So it was almost like a master's degree for me in coaching, working with those guys.
You know, it's also interesting too, not too many people talk about it, but you had international experience as a player going over to Sweden and playing goal in the Swedish league. How did that come upon your career?
I played and coached over in Sweden, Pierre. It was something that I wanted to do. And then my senior year at Yale, literally a gentleman from a team in Sweden came to watch us play against Brown. They were looking for a goalie. And Mark Holden, who was a Montreal draft, was Brown's goalie. And I was playing at Yale, and I happened to have a good game. And he contacted me the next day and asked me if I'd be interested in going to Sweden.
And I know you did a lot of work for the Washington Capitals when you were coaching and working over in Sweden. That eventually led to you being an assistant coach with the Capitals. How much did you change how you evaluated players from North America to Europe based on your experience over there as a scout?
I mean, I think all of our experiences, if we're smart, impact what we do next. And I think having the opportunity to scout NHL players in Europe and seeing how they had to come up through their system, which was very different than our North American system. Obviously, there are a lot more skills involved, and national teams were a big part of their development. And Jack Button was my boss in Washington when I was scouting in Washington, and he was a great mentor for me and really taught me an awful lot.
Jack's an iconic figure in the scouting business, as Keith knows. It's just for our viewers and listeners out there. His son Craig's gone on to have a fantastic career. His other son Todd's gone on to have a tremendous career with the Calgary Flames. What was Jack like as a boss?
Jack was great. He was really, really smart, and he was always asking questions, always probing, sometimes asking questions that he already knew the answer to, just to see how you would go about things and what your opinion was. He didn't want to hear me tell him what I thought he wanted to hear. He really wanted to know what I thought about a player and a situation. And I think his intelligence and his work ethic are the two things that really stick out to me in that regard.
I love how you just described that, because that reminds me so much of the great Scotty Bowman, who was obviously my mentor and somebody that I respect so much. He knew the answer to most of the questions he was asking. He wanted to make sure you had pretty good answers to the questions and that you weren't lying to him. Timmy Taylor is an iconic figure in all of hockey, not just at Yale, not just at Harvard, not just internationally. Iconic figure. We lost Timmy way too young. How much of an impact did Coach Taylor have on your career?
Well, Timmy had a great impact on my career. I mean, you have to remember, I played for him for 4 years. So I got that side of it. And then when I got into coaching, my very first coaching job was an assistant of Tim's. So now I get to work with him. And I think one of the things that gave me a lot of confidence as a young coach, and it's something I always remembered, is was my first week back being an assistant coach with Timmy, and I was up in the press box. And I came down after the first period and he said, what did you see? And I'm thinking, this is Tim Taylor asking me what I saw. And I told him, and he went in the room and almost verbatim, that's what he gave the guys. And I'm thinking, holy cow, like Timmy appreciates what I'm bringing here. You know, maybe I could be okay at this. That's one of a zillion Tim Taylor stories, but that was the first time when I said, Timmy thinks maybe I can coach.
Oh, yeah. No, he spoke so highly. I talked to him so much and so much respect for Coach Taylor. I'll never forget this. And you might appreciate this, Keith. Before the 2014 Olympics, I know he was pretty sick at the time, but I remember going to a game. Doc Emmerich and I were working at Boston College because it was an NHL work stoppage at the time. And I remember talking to Tim, and he was talking about different players around. He wanted to know your opinion. He was asking Doc his opinion, asking me my opinion, and he was making copious notes. Was he a big note taker?
He was a big note taker, but he was also one of those guys, I'm not sure he knew where he put them. You know, and even after games, you know, he was writing things on napkins when you're out having a cocktail after a game, whatnot. So he was always writing stuff down, but he had some in this pocket, some in that pocket, some in that briefcase. He was classic that way.
One of the most amazing things I saw in my coaching career early on was Badger Bob Johnson. He always had those little notebooks and he would make unbelievable notes, copious amounts of notes. And one day there were all these boxes behind his desk and I didn't want to go back there, but I said, hey, coach, what are all those boxes? He goes, those are all my books. And he could go back all the way to when he was coaching at Colorado College, when he was coaching in Wisconsin. All those books were saved. Now, I don't know what happened to him. Both he's passed away and obviously his wife, Martha, passed away. But I think there's such an important element to that. I don't know if you did it, but I tried to do it after Bob. I kept all my notes almost like in a briefcase and then I'd put them somewhere in my house. Did you ever do anything like that?
Yeah, I did the exact same. And it's funny, you know, moving out of my office at Yale this summer, I've got every practice plan I've had for the last 19 years. And then I've got the notes on the games pregame and postgame. And then you wonder, what am I going to do with these things? Right. But I certainly, as a working coach, would go back from time to time and see, okay, what do we do in practice in January of 2012 or 13? And what were my thoughts after this game? And just to kind of remind myself where I've been and kind of help me where I'm going.
01 and 02, you were the head coach for Team USA's World Junior teams. You finished fifth place both times. And then I was broadcasting the games in 2011 when you were in Buffalo. Your team lost a heartbreaker in the semifinal of a really good Canadian team. But I remember watching you run practice before the bronze medal game against Sweden. And I was blown away by how hard you pushed your players that morning skate. Was there a rhyme and reason to it? Because eventually you won the bronze medal game. But I was like, I've never seen an American team push this hard before a bronze medal game.
Yeah, there was a reason, Pierre. I mean, first of all, you know, and we won that bronze medal against a really good Swedish team.
Yeah, you did.
They were outstanding. But, you know, we're talking about the Olympics. And I was on the staff of the Olympics in 1992. And we had kind of a miraculous run. We surprised a lot of people, picked to finish eighth or ninth. And then we lost to Alex Kovalev and the whatever they were called, the Russian type team or the Federation team in the semis. And so the guys, we've been together since July and the guys were packing up and signing autographs. And we got smoked in the bronze medal game by the Czechs. That was Czechoslovakia, I think, at the time. And I saw the joy that they had to be winning a bronze medal. And for us, I felt like as a coach, I failed because we didn't do a good enough job of getting our guys excited to play in that game. And I always felt if I ever had another opportunity, I was going to do everything in my power as a coach to help our guys win a medal in a major event. And that's kind of what it was all coming from that day.
It's a phenomenal story. I remember sitting in the old arena in Buffalo. I think they called it the HSBC Center at the time. Yeah. Now I think it's Key Bank. They change all the time. I was watching that. There weren't a lot of people at your practice. I'm watching going, oh, I hope he knows what he's doing here. But see, I didn't know that side of the story. That's awesome to know that. That's great. You talked about the Olympic experience. You were there in 92. You were there in 2006. A little different. Amateur players versus professional players. And then you went back in 18, you were an assistant with Tony Granato. I was broadcasting those games for NBC. What's the biggest difference between having NHL players at the Olympics and having amateur and mostly college players at the Olympics like you did in 92 and you did in 2018?
Yeah, I mean, each one of those experiences was unique in its own way, Pierre. You know, in 92, it was before NHL players were ever eligible. And so we picked our team in July. We traveled around, played every NHL team, went to Europe three or four times. And we really had an opportunity to build a team. You know, and Dave Peterson was our head coach, and he was a tremendous mentor to me and gave me lots of freedom as a young coach, probably more than I deserved. But it was just a great coaching experience building a team through that process. And, you know, you're adding players and letting players go through that whole time, too, which is not easy. But so we built an Olympic team and went as a team to the Olympics. 2006 in Torino, you know, it's the NHL's involved and we pick our club through the fall, but we don't get together until we're on the plane going to Italy. And so it's, you know, you're managing things and trying to, from a coaching standpoint, keep things as simple as possible and get the guys to play together. But that's a different challenge from a coaching perspective. And then 18, you know, the NHL was away and we built a team of European pros and it was really cool because these are kids who never, ever dreamed they'd get an Olympic experience and to be able to share that with them. And then I had three of my former Yale players on that team as well. Yeah. So each of them was special, but they were very different experiences.
What do you see for this Olympics?
Well, I think we have a great team. I really do. I think we've got a lot of our good players are in their prime. We've got a great combination of skill and grit. And then having said that, Canada's got a great team. And I don't think Sweden's going to be too far off track. But as an American, and you know how we are, particularly with the Olympics, if we don't win gold, there'll be disappointment here in the country. But I think if we don't win gold, we're going to have a hell of a tournament and we're going to make a team play really well to beat us. That's what I think.
I'm not going to ask you to second guess any of the decisions because I think every guy that's on that team merits being on that team. I really, truly do. And I would never disrespect any of them. I'm wondering what your thought process is in a player like Cole Caulfield and your thought process on a player like Lane Hutson. I know you're watching a lot of NHL games right now because you're not really involved in the college game. What's your take on those guys?
I mean, they're Olympic quality players. Okay, that's my first take. And then I think as a staff, and I'm sure Billy and Sully and these guys do this, you know, okay, well, you know, we're building a team and we want to put people in the roles that they will excel at. And Lane is a specific type player. Now, is there anyone else we have that we think might be a little better than Lane in that role? And are we going to go with him or are we going to take Lane? And the same with Cole. So it's difficult. And I'll share with you a story if you can.
Oh, I love it. I want you to say it. Go for it.
Early on, I was my coaching career, I was coaching a U.S. Select 17 team. And it was a different then. We would have everyone in Colorado Springs. We'd have a camp for a week, and then we'd pick a team and go play Canada, or we'd go to the Pacific Cup or whatever. And I had watched how all the NHL scouts carved the USA coaches about who they selected. It was this, you know, it's all politics and this and that. And I said, well, you know what? The night before I picked my team, I went to every scout in the stands, and I gave him a piece of paper. And I said, I want you to pick a team for me. And you know, I got them all together and nobody had the same team. These are all good hockey people, all smart hockey people who were there all week watching the camp. Everyone had a different team. And the thing that stood out to me most was it was a year we took Chris Drury on that team. And he was my best player. And only one of 20 scouts had him making my team. So it's difficult to pick the right team. And we all as hockey people, we have our bias is not the same. We like certain things in certain players that other guys don't, or we appreciate certain things, or we think this is going to help us win. And so we'll all pick different teams. And the beauty of it is right now, America's in a place where we've got a lot of qualified Olympic type hockey players.
Well said. I totally agree. We're talking about the men's team. Let's just switch base a little bit and talk about the growth of women's hockey. I know Yale's had a tremendous program for a long time. I think the ECAC has basically dominated women's hockey at the collegiate level for a very long time. When did you know that women's hockey was really going to take off and start to surge?
I mean, I don't know if I can go back and look at there's a moment that I knew. I can tell you that in the run-up to the 98 Olympics, I got fired in Washington, and I was working with Nashville, helping them put their expansion team together. And Ben Smith, who was Tim Taylor's assistant when I played at Yale, was the 98 women's head coach. And he asked me if I'd come help him run some practices. They were in Walpole, Massachusetts, and spent some time with the goalies. So I spent, over the course of that fall, maybe 2 weeks with that team. And I knew it was my first experience coaching women athletes. And I knew they were quality people. They were dedicated athletes and they were talented. And so I guess that was my first exposure. And then they went on and they won the gold medal. And so I knew then that it was for real.
98 was an amazing experience to watch the gold medal game between Canada and the United States. It was off the charts good. Since 02, I've done every single women's Olympic tournament except for Beijing when I was working back in the NHL. My big moment was 98, like you talk about, Keith, but I also think 2010 in Vancouver. I remember doing the gold medal game. I was working with Doc Emmerich at the time. And Marie-Philippe Poulin scores this unbelievable goal. She gets two goals in the gold medal game. And Mark Johnson, one of the heroes of the 1980 Olympic team, I don't have to tell you, you know him very well. He looks at me between the benches and he just shakes his head. And I'm like, what's he shaking his head at? And then I realized afterwards I had a chance to talk to him. He's talking about or looking at me, or marveling at the way Marie-Philippe Poulin could shoot the puck. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, there were so many young women and ladies that watched that. That kind of changed the approach of all the women players out there because of how good Marie-Philippe Poulin was. I don't know if you ever had a chance to see her play, and if you did, do you have any comments on her?
I honestly haven't, Pierre, so I can't respond to that one, but I'll take your word for it.
If I were a scout in women's hockey, she would be one of my top players, and she's still a great player. She plays for Montreal in the PWHL. Let's talk about the Olympics this year and how you see things going on a smaller rink potentially in Europe. You're used to seeing bigger hockey on bigger rinks in Europe. It's going to be smaller this year. Does that play a role at all in how this thing will be turned out?
Oh, I think it certainly does. I think it favors players that have been playing in North America for the last couple of years, and it's subtle, but there's a difference playing on the big rink, and the game is different. And I like the proximity. I just think it lends to more physicality. And if you want to preview this Olympics, I mean, the Four Nations tournament last late winter, early spring was the best commercial I've ever seen in my life for an upcoming Olympic Games. I think we're all excited about it.
Yeah, that's really well said. The physicality in last year's Four Nation event was off the charts, especially the Saturday night massacre between Canada and the United States was amazing. You talked about, the physicality on smaller ice. Why are the Swedes so good at developing players?
I think it's a complicated question. I do think they do a great job at a younger age, keeping kids in their home clubs, not chasing championships or super teams, and just working on skills and skill development and joy and passion and having fun. And I think that breeds a pretty wide pool of talented players. And I do like their club system for development, and then I want to say it might be 25, 30 years ago now, they developed these systems that are called hockey gymnasiums, sports gymnasiums, which is basically what they call high schools. And these elite athletes come. And they take hockey theory, they take hockey skill training in combination with their regular high school. And I just think it, and they do it with other sports too. It's not just hockey. But I think they do a fantastic job. And they're a sports loving culture. They love hockey. It's a tradition to them. And I think that helps breed it as well. But they do a wonderful job.
Keith, I marvel at how many defensemen they produce year in and year out. It's just phenomenal. And you look at the size of them, they're not small guys. These are men that could play, you know, Division I football and be tight ends or, you know, outside linebackers. Just amazing the athleticism of the defensemen that they grow over there. What about the goaltending in Finland? You're such a good goalie person. Why are the Finns so good at developing goaltenders?
I think they take it seriously. I think the Finns are really analytical people. I hate to generalize, but they are. They're smart, and there's a math orientation to what they do. And they've got goaltending down to a science. They've got developing goaltenders down to a science, and they progress all the way up. They start at a young age, and they do a really good job physically, mentally, tactically with these young goaltenders. And, you know, sometimes you could say they're a little bit cookie cutter. They look the same, but they're really, really good. And they've been doing it for a long time.
For the longest time, I really thought the Germans were going to grow their brand and their footprint in hockey. And it looks like they're starting to, but it looks like it's not as fast as I thought it would be. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know why. I agree with you. I thought it was coming, you know, and then we had Ole Kolzig and Wash, who was born in Germany, but grew up in Canada. But, you know, he was on their Olympic team. And we also had a German boy, Stefan Ustorf, who mm-hmm. we drafted in Washington. And then you thought that they might be the next class. I don't know personally what they're doing at the younger levels. You know, what their youth hockey's like. But if they were smart, they'd go look at Sweden and see, because it's a big country. They've got resources. And I think they like their hockey in Germany as well.
They do. You know what really blew me away? I thought if they had won the gold medal in 2018 and they lost because of an icing and a guy named Kirill Kaprizov for Russia, who took the game over, the gold medal game. I think if Germany wins that, we're not having this discussion. I think everything changed because all the money that would have been flowing into German hockey, but we'll see how it goes long-term. But I do find them to be a fascinating country in terms of hockey development. But I love what you said. They should be studying what's going on in Sweden, because I agree with that. That's a great point. We'll leave on this. When you think about all of your international experience, what's the one thing that you would say USA needs to follow in order to be successful at this Olympics?
What they need to follow. I'll answer it this way, Pierre. I feel like, and I think they're well on the way based on the four nations, but I feel like to be successful in these short-term events where you're trying to build a team overnight is who comes together more quickly as a team. Who accepts their roles, because these guys are all superstars in their own right, and who really cares about the next guy more than they do themselves. And then having said that, I'm going to say also, though, you know what? I think they're there that way. Canada is there as well, right? So it's going to be a bounce of a puck, maybe at the end of the day. But I do think the way to give yourself a real chance of success is to be a team and play together and play for each other. And I do think that this group has that.
You're truly one of the most amazing hockey lifers the ECAC has ever produced. I'm not kidding you, Keith. I could talk to you for hours about this because I'm fascinated. Your takes are so good. Thanks a lot for taking the time to be part the second time on ECAC Hockey Decision Makers. And I hope you're enjoying your time on Cape Cod.
Thanks, Pierre. I appreciate the compliment. And maybe if you ask me for a third time, I'll ask for compensation. I don't know. You have to fly me to South Carolina.
I'll give you a golf game in South Carolina. How's that?
That's wonderful. Good seeing you.
Thank you, Keith.
The ECAC Hockey Championship returns to Lake Placid, New York this March. Witness the first ever ECAC Hockey Women's Championship in Lake Placid on March 6th and 7th, and the Men's Championship on March 20th and 21st. It happens at the legendary Herb Brooks Arena, the home of miracles.
You believe in miracles? Yes!
Don't miss the battle for the 2026 title and an NCAA bid. Tickets are on sale now at LakePlacidOlympicCenter.com. ECAC Hockey, the educated decision.